We'll move to the next case, Monahan versus WorldPay U.S. We're talking about bringing in the...
Yes, it was late last night.
Yeah, well, I sent the word that Jackson wrote, and it must not have gotten back.
Unfortunately.
May it please
Ms. Farahani.
Yes, Farahani.
Yes.
Yes. May it please the court. My name is Amanda Farahani, and I'm here on behalf of Susan Monahan, and I appear with Gail Coleman on behalf of the EEOC, who will address the retaliation issues and the erroneous application of the severe or pervasive standard to retaliation. There are three issues that are before the court today. The first is whether a jury could find that a reasonable person would be dissuaded from raising complaints of discrimination if their manager berated them for it, including telling them that they are blackballed, their days are numbered, and that another employee is being trained for that position. In deciding this issue, the court must address whether a plaintiff can lose her right to a jury trial by being forced into a legal framework of the defendant's choosing under claims that she did not bring, and that under law that is contrary to the Supreme Court of the United States and under an erroneous standard.
Well, let's start with your comment that their claim she didn't bring. The complaint doesn't allege a claim for retaliatory harassment or hostile work environment, right?
Correct. It does not, Your Honor.
So that claim should be out of the case. As I read the complaint, your claim was that the retaliation consisted essentially of her termination.
Well, two issues. One was the conduct by Ms. Daniels, and then the second was her termination. And so first, Ms. Daniels retaliated against Ms. Monahan by bringing her in, berating her, and that those actions itself constitute retaliation. The second portion of the retaliation claim is the retaliation that occurred when she was terminated. And so each of those were evaluated differently by the court, the first under the wrong standard, the second also erroneous.
Well, my reading of what happened is this, and you can tell me if you think I have it right or wrong, and I'll ask your colleague the same thing. The magistrate judge believed or thought that Ms. Monahan had alleged a claim for retaliation based on a retaliatory hostile environment / harassment, addressed that claim, and then the parties addressed that claim too in different ways. And so it morphed into an independent claim, and then the magistrate judge and the district court ended up applying standards for that claim to what Ms. Monahan had pled.
So
I have it right or close to right?
Very close to right, Your Honor. Yes, that was what the magistrate did. We objected that we had not brought a retaliatory harassment hostile work environment claim. We brought a retaliation claim. We did not bring anything under Gowski. Instead, what we brought was a retaliation claim that was based on two different sets of conduct. The first was Ms. Daniels' conduct, and the second was the conduct of being terminated. So when looking at the conduct for Ms. Daniels' conduct, the question is whether what Ms. Daniels did was reasonably likely to persuade someone to not bring a claim of discrimination. And the district court said that the actions were highly inappropriate, but then took a severe or pervasive standard, applied it to that situation, which again is an erroneous standard. I'm not going to get into that standard too much, as the EEOC will be addressing that. The second issue is whether the termination decision itself was erroneous, in that whether the facts are so obvious and indisputable that the only remaining truly debatable matters are a legal question as to whether Ms. Harubala, when she told the plaintiff she was firing her for complaining, did not know that she was firing her for complaining about discrimination. And framing it in that way, it should be clear that that is, in fact, an issue of fact. And a reasonable jury could evaluate the evidence, use common sense and knowledge, and realize that in this situation, the facts there point to evidence that when the decision maker told the plaintiff that because of her complaints, and plaintiff had made no complaints that did not include discrimination or retaliation, that the decision...
Wait. No complaints that didn't involve prohibited discrimination? There's a written complaint, a memo in the file, the only thing written down, and it doesn't have one word about prohibited conduct. That's true, isn't it?
She did not submit that. There are documents in the file that say that, but the documents that contain information about her complaints are written by Mr. McGarricky and Mr.
But her complaint, she wrote her complaint.
So she did not
have... Do I have that wrong?
Those are notes that were submitted, but that was not a complaint that was written. Her complaints were verbal, and to the extent that she tried to provide a written complaint, she was told not to. She was also told not to include the discrimination in those. But the testimony, Your Honor, is that...
This memo I'm looking at ends, at the end I rose and said, this is highly inappropriate, and went back to my desk. This is her handwritten account of the meeting where she says she was berated.
Yes, Your Honor, as is document 7, exhibit 7, as well as her handwritten account that goes through and explains in more detail everything that she did and said. Those were not provided to the defendant at the time. Those are after-the-fact documents that were provided in discovery.
So how is it that when she wrote down her account of this, she didn't say one word about race, age, or anything prohibited?
She was specifically told not to do that by Steve Karp, to not include information about the discrimination by also Mr. McGarricky. There are multiple people who told her that. But what's important here is that the testimony is that what she did is on each time that she went and orally complained, she included allegations of race and age or retaliation. And that's the testimony that the court has to rely on here.
Is there anything in the record that suggests that Ms. Daniel even knew that she had that Ms. Monahan had complained about the berating meeting?
Yes, Your Honor. On page 164 of the plaintiff's deposition, she specifically identifies that Ms. Daniel said that she was berating her for complaining about discrimination.
That doesn't say she knew about this meeting.
That Ms. Daniels knew about?
Right, about the meeting where Ms. Monahan says Ms. Daniels berated her. I couldn't find anything in the record suggesting that Ms. Daniels even knew that Ms. Monahan had ever complained about that meeting.
Ms. Watkins, Your Honor, or Ms. Harubla?
Ms. Daniels, whether Ms. Daniels knew that Ms. Monahan had complained about that meeting.
Which meeting, Your Honor?
The one that went on for an hour and 15 minutes, according to Ms. Monahan, and she ended up by saying this is highly inappropriate and went back to her desk.
That meeting was with Ms. Daniels, Your Honor.
Yes. The question is, did Ms. Daniels know that Ms. Monahan had complained to up the chain about that?
Yes, Your Honor. On page 164, Ms. Monahan says that Ms. Daniels told her that she was aware that Ms. Monahan had complained about discrimination.
That's a different question, but I take your answer. All right, thank you.
Okay.
I had one other question, if I could take just a second, a question about the record. You say that the policies required Ms. Rubla to be involved in the actual decision. I couldn't find the policies in the record. Are the policies that you say have this provision, are they in the record?
Your Honor, if they're not in the record, Ms. Watkins herself actually testified to that, that those policies are in effect, and also Ms. Watkins testified that she coached Ms. Harubla through the termination process and provided counseling to her, which according to Corbett versus Home Depot, which is directly on point and almost factually identical to this case, is sufficient to allow for a genuine issue of material fact for a jury on that issue of whether the decision maker knew.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Coleman.
May it please the court, Gail Coleman for the EEOC. Whether or not this court reaches retaliatory harassment on the merits, It is critical for the court to correct the legal error that Gowski controls the analysis, and this is the reason the EEOC is here today. The Supreme Court in Burlington held that retaliation is actionable even if the conduct does not violate the substantive anti-discrimination provision. And the reason for that is that the substantive provision and the anti-retaliation provision have different language and different purposes. The substantive provision speaks in terms of discrimination in terms or conditions of employment, and the anti-retaliation provision is not limited in this way. And the reason for that is because the effectiveness of the substantive provisions depends entirely on the willingness of employees to complain. For that reason, Burlington held that the anti-retaliation provision prohibits any action that might deter a reasonable employee from complaining. In Crawford versus Carroll, a case which is cited in the appellant's reply brief, this court described the Burlington standard as, quote, decidedly more relaxed than the substantive standard. It said that the substantive standard and the retaliation standard are, and I quote, distinct and different.
What do we do with Gostkowski?
Well, exactly. That is the question. So Gowski ignored both of these precedents. It ignored Burlington, which as a Supreme Court...
It cited an Eighth Circuit case and a Sixth Circuit case, both of which relied on Burlington.
No, Gowski relied very heavily on a First Circuit case, which relied on pre-Burlington law.
Well, that was pre-Burlington, but it cited two Burlington, post-Burlington cases.
Gowski did
our,
not.
Our court cited two post-Burlington cases, but did not pick up the test.
Not in Gowski. Gowski simply assumed, without citing to Burlington, no discussion of Burlington and no analysis of Burlington.
Oh, I understand.
But also, the jury instructions there were the severe or pervasive instructions. Both sides agreed to them, and that was the standard that went up. So when you're reviewing a case where... the jury instructions were given that way, and you're talking about whether the facts are sufficient, you really stuck with the jury instructions that both sides agreed to.
Well, that may be the case, but then that would not make Gowski a binding precedent on this issue. Really, the binding law is Burlington and Crawford versus Carroll under this own court's prior precedent rule. So again, I would urge this court to recognize that Gowski, whether for the reason that Judge Hinkle has just offered or for the reason that it was already bound by previous precedent, that Gowski was wrong to the extent it has been interpreted as holding that the standard for retaliatory harassment differs from the standard for any other form of retaliation.
Your position is that the adversity requirement for retaliation is the same no matter which form the retaliation takes. Whether they are reprimands, decrease in salaries, harassment, etc. It's whether or not the action taken, if believed, would dissuade a reasonable employee or person from complaining about prohibited conduct.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. There is nothing in Burlington or in Crawford that would justify any kind of carve-out for retaliatory harassment. So even if that harassment does not rise to the level of severe or pervasive conduct that would warrant a substantive discrimination claim, if it satisfies the Burlington standard, if it might deter a reasonable employee from complaining about discrimination, then it would still be actionable as retaliation. And if there are no further questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time back to the appellant.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Barrow.
May it please the court, I am Tracy Maurer, counsel for WorldPay, Appellee WorldPay, Inc. Thank you this morning for this time. I will start first with the Burlington argument, and note that it is, in this circuit, the controlling law has been Galski v. Peek when it comes to retaliatory harassment claims. I will note also that the court has noted that retaliatory harassment was not a claim that was alleged in plaintiff's complaint. The only reference that she had with respect to retaliation
What happened in this case is commonplace in this circuit. Pleadings start out, they're shifted to the magistrate judge, and one thing leads to another, and the complaint gets amended by the parties in their memos back and forth.
Yes, sir.
But here, Ms. Monahan, to Judge Choflat's point, Judge Monahan said that's not the claim we're pleading, right?
Yes, in response to our motion for summary judgment. That is correct.
Right,
she said
so
that
she never tried to amend her complaint through the summary judgment posture. Whether her claim failed or succeeded, she said that's not the claim that we're traveling on. So shouldn't we just forget about it? If she's confirmed here today that that's not a claim she's traveling on, and you don't think it's an appropriate claim, why don't we just wipe that off of the face of the case and move on to the other issues?
I completely agree, Your Honor. It should be gone.
But there remains then her claim for other forms of what she claims are retaliation, right?
Well, the only other form of retaliation that she claimed dealt with her termination, the termination of her employment.
She claimed Ms. Daniels mistreated her.
She claims Ms. Daniels mistreated her.
Whatever you call that, you knew from the time the complaint was filed that part of what she was complaining about was that Ms. Daniels mistreated her, and partly that Ms. Daniels did it in retaliation for complaining about discrimination.
She claims that Ms. Daniels, in the October 2nd meeting, that October 2nd meeting was retaliation for complaining about discrimination. We've noted in our brief that there was no claim for discrimination by Ms. Monahan about Ms. Daniel. But even if we accepted her argument that she was being retaliated against by Ms. Daniel, there is still the requirement that she shows, and our anti-retaliation provisions require a showing that there was some sort of harm or injury. And even under Burlington, where the court has said that an employer's actions must be harmful to the point that they could well dissuade a reasonable worker from making or supporting a charge of discrimination. When we look at the conduct that is alleged and is attributed to Ms. Daniel, there is nothing there that demonstrates that Ms. Monahan was subjected to any conduct that would have dissuaded a reasonable worker from filing a claim. Burlington says that we are required to look at, if we're looking traveling under Burlington, that we're required to look at the context of the case and the circumstances that particular matter. In this case, Ms. Monahan alleged that she had not been trained by Ms. Daniel, for example. She says that, however, that occurred in the first week of her employment before she alleged that there was any form of discriminatory conduct. Even with that, when you listen to what Ms. Monahan had to say about the training, she said she understood that Tammy Daniel believed it had to do with her level of experience as compared to the temporary worker who came in a week later. She agreed it had nothing to do with her age, her race, and that she had not, at that point, had not made any complaints about Tammy. She complained that Tammy Daniel would not allow her overtime, but she also testified that she had not followed the proper procedures and that Tammy told her that the problem with giving her the overtime was because she had not talked with Tammy. Tammy had no idea what the overtime was for. She had not covered that in advance with Ms. Daniel. She complained that, or at least her other conduct that she attributes to Tammy, concerns whether Ms. Daniel said and told the temporary contract worker that I am training you for Susan's job, for Ms. Monahan's job. And again, when we look at the record, number one, the contract worker says that never happened. But number two, Ms. Daniel never did anything about it. I mean, it's basically bark and no bite of the conduct that she attributes to Ms. Daniel. She goes on to say and alleges that she was repeatedly threatened and that physical threats of harm came to her. But the fact of the matter is that didn't happen.
You say that didn't happen, but she testified that it did. At summary judgment, how can you make that assertion?
She testified that Ms. Daniel said, "Watch it." And she testified that Ms. Daniel said, "I know where you and my boyfriend and I know where you live." She never testified as to what those meant. She never asked
what
those meant.
What do you think a reasonable person would take that to mean?
In the context of this case?
Yes.
There's nothing to suggest that Ms. Daniel was going after her. Ms. Monahan testified.
That's an inference you want to draw, but I'm not sure it's the only inference.
Well, Ms. Monahan testified that she was not afraid of Ms. Daniel. She testified that she didn't believe that Ms. Daniel was going to do anything to her.
The point is not whether or not an employee subjectively becomes afraid, but whether or not the alleged conduct by an employer or supervisor would dissuade a reasonable person from complaining. You don't think there's any of that in this case?
I don't, because she did in fact complain.
No, that's a different question.
I understand what you're saying.
That's a different question. I'm assuming a complaint. I know you've got arguments about that.
About what she complained?
Yes, there's a different, you know, the analysis proceeds in different steps. She has to make a complaint about prohibited conduct, or at least have a reasonable belief that she's complaining about that. And then there has to be action that is deemed retaliatory. I'm talking about that second step, the retaliatory part. You don't think that anything that Ms. Daniels did, according to Ms. Monahan, can be deemed retaliatory under Burlington Northern?
Not even under Burlington Northern, including the cases that were cited by plaintiff, because they don't. Burlington Northern also requires that there be some level of materiality to the complaints that are being made or the challenged conduct that's being brought forward. And when you look at those cases, there was something material that actually happened in those cases. In Davis v. Florida Agency for Health Administration, for example, the plaintiff was given an unfavorable performance evaluation after she filed a grievance with HR. Daniel provided no unfavorable performance reviews in this case, for example. In Corbett v. Home Depot, there were two supervisors where the evidence was clear that there were retaliatory motives that influenced and they participated in a group decision to terminate plaintiffs after they supported a retaliation claim. And Daniel had nothing to do with that. I mean, she had nothing to do with termination. She was already gone. She did not leave anything in Ms. Monahan's personnel file about her. She didn't have discussions with anyone about Ms. Monahan going forward that would have had some impact into the future on Ms. Monahan. So,
when did Ms. Daniels leave compared to Ms. Monahan's termination?
She left about 2 weeks before Ms. Monahan left, but that was a decision that had been made prior to that.
What do we do on the third point about Ms. Raba's alleged statement that she told Ms. Monahan that she was being terminated for complaining?
We disregarded the statement, but I understand. With the complaint,
you can't disregard it. It may not have probative value. It may be legally irrelevant. It may be legally insufficient, but you can't disregard it. She's the one who, according to you, made the termination decision for Ms. Monahan, right?
That is correct.
So she's the decision maker, according to you.
She is the decision maker.
So what she says is relevant. It may be legally insufficient, but whatever she says is certainly relevant.
Right, Your Honor, and we did argue that she, what the comment that Ms. Monahan attributed.
What do we do with it?
What do you do with that statement?
What do we do with the statement?
Well, we look at the statement for, you know, plaintiff argued that it was direct evidence of retaliation, and you look at the nature and character of the statement and say, what, you know, what do we know about this? When we look in the record, Ms. Harubala said that what she knew about complaining was that Ms. Monahan complained about her workload. Mr. McGarrigle testified that she complained about the workload. So I think it's reasonable to state that based on the record and the fact that Ms. Monahan herself said that she has never complained to Ms. Harubala, to April Watkins, the head of HR, the president of the company, or HR itself about alleged discrimination, that it is a reasonable inference from the record that Ms. Harubala was not making a comment about discrimination. There is no evidence in the record that any other person had a conversation with Ms. Harubala about alleged discriminatory complaints from Ms. Monahan. So I think the record is enough to be able to say that when you look at it as a whole, the reasonable inference is that Ms. Harubala did not have sufficient information. In fact, she had no information that Ms. Monahan had made complaints of discrimination when she made the termination decision.
And I take it one of the proffered legitimate non-retaliatory reasons for the termination was that Ms. Monahan was a complainer. She did a lot of complaining. She got this single-spaced memo complaining about all manner of things, just not about discrimination.
But not about discrimination, that is correct. And she says that that she wanted to provide her complaint to Mr. McGarrigle or Mr. Karp, and again, she testified that that was the document that she intended to give them, and she also testified and acknowledged that there's nothing on that document that alleges age or race discrimination. So on that point, with respect to her discharge, WorldPay respectfully submits that the district court properly affirmed summary judgment, or properly provided summary judgment, and we respectfully ask that that be affirmed as well. Plaintiff mentioned that, and I think that this court has already spoken on as recently as June of this year in the Jefferson v. Swan America matter that summary judgment does not violate the Seventh Amendment, and summary judgment in employment cases can be appropriate and is appropriate where there are no disputed genuine facts. And that is the case here as well. We believe that is a closed issue, although it was certainly argued by appellant in this matter. With also, we'll note that plaintiff argued regarding interested parties in Reeves, and this court has consistently held that these conclusory allegations without specific supporting facts have no probative value. And that goes back again, I think, to the Harubala discussion. And also with regard to the Harubala discussion, this court in Clover made sure Clover also indicated and was clear that just because people in a corporation may have discussions does not mean that they talked about a specific issue. Similarly, in Brungart v. Bell South Telecommunications, the fact that an employer is a corporation does not relieve a plaintiff of the burden of showing a causal connection between the protected conduct and the decision to take adverse action. The question is that their argument is that she could have been told, Ms. Harubala, about this. The question is, was she told? And the record does not provide us any evidence of that. Thank you,
Your
Honor.
We have your case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, you asked the question, what do we do with the statement that she was fired because she was complaining? And Your Honor, the answer to that is you let the jury decide what that statement means. Yes, there are reasonable inferences that could be taken on the facts of this case against the plaintiff, but that's a jury decision to make, whether the reasonable inferences that the defendant asserts are the ones that the jury decides or the ones that we assert are the ones that the jury should decide.
Tell me the complaints that were made in good faith, taking into account the law of the circuit that even a vile racial epithet is not sufficiently hostile to be actionable, and that because the law on that is settled, a complaint even about a vile racial epithet does not constitute a good faith protected complaint.
Well, Your Honor, the Jefferson case shows that it need not go that far in order for there to be a good faith underlying belief that there is a reasonable claim.
Yeah, My question was for help with the record. What were the complaints that you say were protected?
Yes, so she complained on 4 separate occasions. On each of those occasions that she complained, she raised issues that she specifically said were race and age discriminatory comments, including the comments about the suntan comment,
okay,
the white
so
girls.
The suntan remark can't possibly be as bad as directly using the N-word.
Correct.
And yet the law of the circuit is that's not protected, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And
all right.
The law is...
And the you white girls get me, that's the same thing. That's not nearly as bad as the racial epithet. True?
True, Your Honor.
All right, so that's 2 of the 4. What are the other 2?
Right, Your Honor. And if we parse each one of them out individually, then we can easily say each one on their own is not something that is recoverable. But in a case where you've got multiple instances that are happening over a period of time and multiple complaints that are being brought forward to multiple people, then we have to look at the context of what's happened in order to make a decision about whether there's a reasonable underlying good faith belief.
Before you move on, what were the other two?
The other two were... Wow, I just threw a blank. The other two were based on the screaming and yelling. So it was the retaliatory comments telling her that she was going to cut her throat, that this was because of her age, telling her that she was too old, telling her she didn't fit in. There were comments about her clothing, dressing like an old lady, about food that she ate. And throughout every one of the comments that she's made, yes, there were complaints that she also brought about work-related issues. But the testimony in the case is that every single time that she came forward with a complaint, that part of her complaint included claims of age and race discrimination, using the words discrimination, using the words that she believed that she was being harassed.
Who did she make those complaints to? What is the best testimony or evidence in the record that she told somebody at Wordplay, I'm being discriminated on the basis of either race or age?
There are multiple parts of the plaintiff's testimony where she says she told Bernie McGargle, where she told Steve Karp, where she also was talking to Lucas, where Patty Newcomer, another management individual, was there, that they raised those issues forward to the executive branch, and that then Ms. Daniel came to her and said, you have been complaining to me about discrimination. Then you turn to what the knowledge would be that Ms. Harubla knew, and you look at the context again. Yes, Ms. Harubla herself says that she didn't know anything, but you don't have to believe her for the purposes of summary judgment, and instead you look at the context. And the context in this case shows that Ms. Watkins was involved and Ms. O'Neill was involved all the way throughout. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. The last case, Houston Specialty Insurance versus Vaughn and all Florida.
May it please
Mr. Derrick?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Robert Dara, and I represent Houston Specialty. Basically, I sort of look at this case in three aspects. One is that the trial court erred in applying the Claims Administration Act to Houston Specialty. It was then used to find that Houston Specialty had not complied with it. That's erroneous for two reasons. One, we are a surplus lines carrier not subject to the Act, and two, because even if the Act applied, we complied. The second issue is that the court then failed to grant summary judgment to Houston Specialty on non-cooperation. And then the third is whether or not Mr. Mendenhall had an obligation to cooperate with Houston Specialty. Well,
those two latter issues go by the wayside if you are wrong on the first one, right?
Correct.
So let's talk about that one if we could first. How is it that an insurance company doesn't know for over 2 years what policy it has issued and affirmatively represents that it has issued a different policy to the policyholder and then isn't held to that?
I think first,
this
John...
Not, this is not a mistake. As I read the record, and I read a lot of it, because I too was wondering why the judge had done what she ultimately did. But this is not a mistake of turning over the wrong policy in discovery and then recognizing a mistake, or maybe even including the wrong policy in your deck action complaint and then saying, oh, we made a mistake, here's an amended complaint, and here's the correct policy. It seems like your client did nothing for a long, long time to ascertain the policy it had issued. And everybody litigated on the assumption that you had issued a different policy. Why shouldn't you be held to that?
First, I don't want to nitpick words, but let me separate one thing. The policy itself, the language of the policy is identical in both.
Except for the surplus lines language, which is critical.
Yes. That is true. That I don't agree that the surplus lines language is critical, but it is statutorily required as evidence that that policy was.
If your client issues a, although it may not be authorized to do so, if your client issues a policy through an authorized broker or agent that doesn't have that language, is it a surplus policy?
It would be, we would be a surplus lines carrier only authorized to do that.
I know. I'm telling you, if you do something that the law doesn't authorize you to do, and you issue a policy without the required statutory language, have you issued a surplus policy or a standard lines policy?
There is no case that deals with that issue.
I but know. I that's why I'm asking you the question.
I would make the argument that that is a de minimis requirement in this case for this reason.
Not
this.
We're going to go case by case.
That's
we,
what
we have to write an opinion. Do you want us to say, well, in this particular case, the language doesn't matter, but we're not deciding other cases where it will matter?
No, Your Honor. And here's the reason. This is a case
what,
where
do you want to stick to the de minimis argument?
Only to one extent, and that is if the court finds that the judge was right under Rule 37 in sanctioning the insurance company in this manner, which we contend we were not. And the main reason we were not is two things happened that are clearly admitted by the appellees, and that's this. Number one, in 2012...
Now you're departing from the language on the policy. Are we talking about the judge's discretion?
No, I'm talking about the language on the policy.
Okay.
That language was physically on the policy actually delivered to the insured in 2012. And it didn't just stop there because the statute also requires more. The statute requires that there be evidence that the insured had no other option to get coverage except a surplus lines policy. The retail agent, the insured's agent, was the one who actually sat down with the insured, according to the undisputed testimony, and said to him, this is a surplus lines policy. It's different. So that was an absolute undisputed fact throughout this case. So there's no question this insured had actual knowledge and produced a copy of the policy belatedly in discovery that contains that language. The reason why it was not attached to the complaint was because it was provided to Houston Specialty through its vendor without that language on it.
I understand that. I've got a little more specific question. Were you the lawyer at the 30B6 deposition?
Yes, Your Honor. You're talking about Houston Specialty. I was at both Houston Specialties
You were the lawyer there. One of the things they say is that deposition's in progress. It's been going on a while, and you reach in your briefcase and pull out the surplus lines policy. I'm trying to think of any possible reason why a lawyer who knows that he's got this bombshell that totally changes the case, or at least may totally change the case, would sit in a deposition in progress with that in the briefcase and not pull it out till later. My question.
We got it the day before, emailed it the day before. When talking to counsel, he said he did not have a copy, and at that point, that is when we brought out a copy, in addition to having sent it to him the day before.
But you had already sent it to the other lawyer?
Emailed it the night before.
Okay.
We got it from their agent, Mr. Sweat, Your Honor, at that point in time.
Yeah, you're talking to their agent without them there, but that's another question. I just wanted to make sure, and maybe you answered it. They said in the brief that I had the impression that the deposition's ongoing, and you're sitting there with this secret in your briefcase. No, you say you gave it to him the night before.
We gave it to him when we got it.
All right.
And so we got it twice, once from their agent during the discovery period in response to some requests that we made with their permission. Their counsel gave us, all Florida's counsel gave us permission to contact the agent.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, we've got an email that's, I believe, in the record that's
all
where
right. Well,
he said you can get that information directly from them. Now, we also went back and tried to get it from our vendor, and in doing that, we got another copy, which we produced, which was identical. That, to me, is the most salient fact on this issue, is we asked them for it. In our initial disclosures, we said, you have a copy of the original policy, and that's relevant. We asked for them to produce it to us. They produced it to us 7 days before the close of discovery. And when they produced it to us, then we went back or double-checked it and said, yep, you're right, this is the one that is the correct one.
And then how would you double-check and know that if you didn't have a copy of it yourself?
Yes. We go back through our vendor. There's a two-step process. There's the folks who actually put the policy together. Then there's the folks who are the surplus authorized agents in the state, the wholesale agents, who then put that language on it, deliver it to the retail agent, Sweat or Star, and then turn around and give it to the insurer.
Why couldn't you have found that information out before?
Candidly, Your Honor, it had not been brought up as a problem that there was not the stamp on it. We got it the first time from our vendor without having the stamp on it.
But you didn't make the argument about being a surplus lines carrier until relatively late in the proceedings. You weren't making that argument from the beginning.
They didn't raise that issue until...
No, you raised the issue.
They didn't raise the issue until they raised it as an affirmative defense in September of 2015. I may have the year wrong, but it's right
You're saying that... They raised the point for the first time in the case.
Yes. What they did, Your Honor,
in the affirmative defense.
Yes. They filed a motion to dismiss. The court ruled on the motion to dismiss just a couple of weeks before the close of discovery, and then they filed their answer in affirmative defense. Now, their affirmative defense does not say you failed to comply in giving us a copy of the policy. It says you failed to comply with the Claims Administration Act. Claims Administration.
Well, that's the same thing.
Not just that in the Claims Administration
Act. Well, they're saying you weren't a surplus carrier.
They didn't say that.
Well, when they say you didn't comply with the Act, that's in effect what they're saying, isn't it?
No, Your Honor. The Act applies to an admitted carrier, and it has requirements in it. Our defense to their defense would be that we are a surplus lines carrier, and that's the reason that came up, not until they raised the affirmative defense.
So
it's not
how long was it between the time they pleaded the defense and the time you found the policy with the language and gave it to them?
I'd have to go, when you say gave to them, they already had it. Gave it to them again, in a sense, was it was right at the end of discovery. I'd have to go back and look.
How much time between?
Less than 30 days, as I recall, Your Honor. I'd have to go back and look at the actual day their answer in affirmative defense was filed, and the day that we then had discovery ending and the day we produced it. But it was a 30-day period of time, essentially, Your Honor. That's why there were subsequently additional discovery that the court allowed on the question of that policy, was because all of that came up in about a 30-day period.
I've got a different question. You're over your time, but this is a different question. It hadn't come up. I'm trying to figure out how you think this was going to work when you tried to intervene in their state court lawsuit. So they both agree, for example, that Mendenhall is an employee. And you want to tell the jury that he's an independent contractor. How's this going to work? Are you going to be at the trial?
No, Your Honor.
So
it's not we're going to tell.
Nobody's going to be taking a different position. Everybody's going to agree he's an employee. That's going to be the only evidence at the trial. But you want to put on the verdict form a question whether he's an employee or an independent contractor?
We think that the purpose of intervening, Your Honor, is to make sure the issues are clear at the trial court level. Let me give you an example.
Is it true or not true that you wanted to put on the verdict form a question whether Mendenhall was an employee or an independent contractor?
Yes. And
so how stupid do you think the jurors are? You don't think the jurors are going to figure out this goes to insurance coverage?
We wouldn't be there. And the purpose of putting it, I don't believe, let me explain.
You don't think jurors are that smart? I mean, let me just tell you, the jurors I get.
I totally believe in the brilliance of the jurors and the jury system. But I believe the judge, if we played this out hypothetically, the judge would not have put that question on the form, right? Because there's no evidence that anybody's going to submit at trial. The obligation that Florida imposes on the insurer when there's a coverage issue that overlaps in the underlying case and in the coverage case is to try to get the trial court to clarify it so that it helps deal with the coverage issue. Then what happens is, if we don't ask, the burden is on us to clarify it in the trial of the coverage case. If we do ask and the insured does not go along with that, then the burden is on the insured to do that.
Can you cite any case where the Florida Supreme Court, or for that matter, a DCA, or even a trial court other than this one, has let the insurance company intervene in circumstances like this?
Yes. And we didn't brief that issue. I can give the court a list. There are literally dozens and dozens. In fact, the appellate court case.
That's turning the whole case into declaratory judgment action in the middle of a damage action.
No. The reason the Florida courts approve.
These are dozens of DCA cases?
Yes. The reason the court authorizes the insurer to intervene is just to ask. Because otherwise, if the verdict itself in the underlying case is unclear, then what the coverage judge and court has to do is say, well, what did the jury do? Who's responsible for proving what the jury does? Is it us?
You just try the issue of whether he's an employee or an independent contractor, which, by the way, you tried and lost.
I couldn't hear the last part of that.
You tried and lost. Judge Kovacovich presided over that trial, and you lost it, right?
Yes. But that's after all of the intervention, and it's after what we were trying to accomplish.
But isn't that the way it's supposed to happen? I mean, we could spend all day. I don't understand how you denied that you had a duty to defend. It seems to me it couldn't be more clear that you had a duty to defend. Now, duty to indemnify is a different question. But under Florida law, the duty to defend is determined under the eight corners rule. Read the complaint, read the policy. Some exceptions, but not one here. I mean, this complaint says Mendenhall's an employee.
There is an exception here, and the exception is for who is an insured. The cases cited in our brief talk about who is an insured. Mr. Mendenhall, every bit of information that was provided to us from All Florida was he is signed an independent contractor agreement. He's an independent salesman. We asked for his W-2 or his 1099, and they wouldn't give it to us.
But it wouldn't be the first time that somebody treated their employees as an independent contractor. It saves money on taxes.
Judge Kennedy, I don't think that's right. I mean, I do think that's not the first time. I think the process is wrong there.
But aren't you supposed to determine the duty to indemnify from the complaint and not from other information you may have? And until a court makes a determination based on evidence, then maybe your duty to defend goes away. But at the beginning, you've got to provide a defense?
No, Your Honor. And the classic example is...
If they say fact is X, and you believe the fact is Y, and if fact Y is correct, there's no coverage. You don't have to defend until you prove fact Y?
There are exceptions for things like late notice. There are exceptions
for... That's a different question altogether.
All of the conditions in the policy...
We're talking about whether or not he's an employee.
We're talking about who is an insured from the coverage standpoint. Who is an insured? He's not an insured as an independent salesman. He's not an insured as an independent contractor. He might
and
be...
The allegation is he's an employee.
They had always pled... Well, if all of the true facts, the people that know are all Florida, and Mr. Mendenhall and Mr. Fulford are telling us that he is an independent contractor, and they are not providing us with a single indicia of evidence that he's not, that doesn't make the fact that it's alleged in the complaint true.
Okay. The cases that say that who's an insured is an exception to the eight corners rule, those are in your brief?
Yes.
I didn't go reread those. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Martinez.
Good morning. May it please the court. Just a point of clarification on the, taking the policy out of the briefcase. Mr. Darrow, I believe, is mistaken and is confusing an email. Nobody on the other side of this case received an email the night before with that policy. I believe he's mistaken on that. There is pointed out in our briefs and in the record that his office received an email with the policy the night before the deposition. And the next day is the first time they presented it, two-thirds, three-quarters of the way through that deposition. But I just wanted to clarify that.
Does the record tell, do you agree that you knew about it the night before?
No. No, to the contrary. That's what I want to correct.
Your brother says that you were told the night before.
I believe he's mistaken. There is an email the night before from Sweat and Crawford to his office delivering the policy to him. I believe he is confusing that email, perhaps, with an email.
You're saying that you first learned about it in the deposition?
Unquestionably. Unquestionably. And if you read the transcript, it's readily apparent. I came out and just said, what's going on here? And we got into a big discussion about why hasn't this been produced?
So it was a break in the questioning. Is that what it was? Or
no, it should be in the transcript. I don't think it was off
no,
the
record. And then you said, no, I'm not going to ask questions about it now. I just got it.
Sure. And you have to recall, right before that deposition, that was the third deposition of the corporate representative. Right before it, they had filed their request for judicial notice, which, by the way, was the first time surplus lines was even whispered. And this is after the close of discovery, request for judicial notice, and so to oppose our summary judgment. Because of that request for judicial notice, we knew we had to finish the corporate rep depot. So in the areas of designation, I said, let me inquire about surplus lines. They opposed it, and they prevailed. And we had an order from Judge Kovacevich saying, you will not go into those questions. So we did not. In that context, three-quarters of the way through a deposition, they pull the policy out and say, by the way, we've been litigating, we've had a trial now and a judgment and an appeal based on this policy, but here's a new one that should apply. At that point, I declined to ask questions because I had an order that had been issued the night, a night or two before saying, don't inquire, so I didn't. So I wanted to make that clear that that deposition was the absolute first time that I was advised of this other policy.
One of the arguments that Houston Specialty makes is that whatever blunders it may have committed, you, your client, had the policy from day one and was asked for it in discovery and didn't produce it until very late. And so why should it be penalized given that you had it within, your client had it within its possession, his possession, at all times?
Because it poisoned our litigation decisions in the meantime. And I'll explain. First of all, there was no request for a policy. The request for production was give us any documents that support your defenses. Our defense was you didn't issue a timely reservation of rights. So there is no document to produce. Our defense was not, hey,
they never asked for the policy, for a copy of the policy?
You will not find that in the record. And we cited in our briefs the actual discovery request. There was no request on our part to us for a policy. and there was no reason for it. We had a certified original that had been produced no fewer than six times through these various three different lawsuits that were going on. One of those had been litigated to conclusion through a trial and appeal based on that policy that was submitted by Houston. The letter
so
asking...
You had no reason to doubt that that was the policy, and you didn't go ask your own client, where's the policy?
Of course not. We had a certified original. There was, you know, in none of these complaints did Houston so much as allege that they were surplus to give us...
Is there anything in the record that establishes that your client knew it was surplus coverage from the start and what the legal ramifications of that were? What a surplus carrier was, for example?
No.
Nothing in the record?
No. My client is a roofing contractor. They're laypersons.
Well, your client's agent explained it to him, I'll put it that way.
Well, Barry Scar says, hey, every time I did this, the agent says, every time I did this, it was surplus lines. That's all we could find. However, every single year, there's a search for coverage. If there's a standard lines policy, that's what
they have
to
go get surplus because they can't get the other.
Yes. Yes. He says it was clear in his mind that it was surplus, but there's no evidence in the record that my client was aware of that or the legal ramifications. And getting to the new policy itself, it does not comply for the reasons we've said in the brief, but what's important is even if I had come across it, even if I had gone and for some reason I needed to go exclude possibilities that I didn't know existed, right, that it was surplus, because that wasn't whispered. And you have to remember, too, that in the letter asking us to reconsider the rejection of the defense, that letter cited to the claims administration statute. So we were under the impression that this was a 627 case, unquestionably.
That it was not.
That it was. That this was standard lines policy, right. Because even Chapter 627 was cited to by Houston in their letter asking us to reconsider the rejection of the defense. Now, while they're asking us to reconsider, we were waiting for the reservation of rights. They have 30 days. During the time frame to reconsider, that letter didn't come. Therefore, there was no reason to reconsider the rejection. That's one of the litigation decisions that was poisoned at the time. There were several others that I could get into, but the prejudice, I think, is patent here. And one of the issues that Judge Kovacevic was troubled by, and you can see it in her order, was the manner in which this developed, which was the first time it was ever whispered, the first time in any record that you see the word surplus is at the close of discovery in the form of a request for judicial notice. That is what prompted us to ask, can we inquire about this at the third, and the third corporate rep depo was set for other reasons, but we said, hey, let us inquire. They objected, that was sustained, and we weren't allowed to get into it. And under those circumstances, that was troubling to Judge Kovacevic. She therefore reopened discovery, and it was 3 months, by the way. Mr. Darrow was mistaken when asked, how long between the time of judicial notice and the time that you actually, in the corporate rep deposition? It's fairly easy to determine, but the judicial notice was in September, and the actual dates are in Judge Kovacevic's order. The corporate rep deposition was December 16th. So that's 3 months later that they actually came up with it. And when we went through the record to find out, hey, when did Houston get a hold of this policy finally, that's when we saw the email that the council had received it the night before. And when you look at that email chain, and this is in the record, it came within 24 hours of the request from Sweat. There was an email to Sweat saying, do you have this? Within 24 hours, Sweat sent it back. And so our contention was it was relatively easy to obtain. But that was a three-month delay, and that's one of the issues that Judge Kovacevic pointed out in her order, was that nowhere in the record was she able to find any justification for that three-month delay. And because of that, she found that under Rule 37, no appropriate justification for the delay had been asserted or was to be found in the record.
Let me ask you a different question. You might have been able to persuade me that as a matter of law, you did not fail to cooperate. But if I understand the briefing, you haven't asserted that here. You don't assert that as a matter of law, you didn't fail to cooperate, and so we can affirm on that basis. I think your brief says you agree with Judge Kovacevic that that's a genuine issue for trial.
I've got to think about that for a moment. It is not a genuine issue for trial because of the issue that we've been discussing here.
Oh, I understand that. But if we disagreed on that and we got to the merits of the question, I guess what I'm saying is you might have persuaded me that you didn't do anything wrong, that when they tried to intervene and the lawyer that they retained to defend you said, I can't even go to the hearing, that things have changed and you've got every right to say, I'm sorry, I can't rely on your lawyer anymore. He didn't even show up at the hearing, which is going to be a pretty big deal. And so we're going to get our own lawyer. You might have persuaded me that that's not a jury issue. That's not a failure to cooperate. That's not an issue for us, right?
I wish I had, now that you say that. But no, you are correct. It was our impression that there was a factual issue on that.
All right.
I'll go over some of the other points briefly. The appellees argue that there's no case law to support the interpretation that we are advocating, but the statute is relatively clear. I mean, 624 says you're either authorized or unauthorized. Then there's an exemption that's carved out if you follow the law, and then you can avail yourself of that exemption if you qualify for it. There is an absence in this record of qualifying for that exemption, not only because of the policy, but because Judge Kovacevic was given no record evidence that this was even an eligible carrier. The request for judicial notice was a printout of a web page that itself said you cannot rely on this, and nothing else was presented. There was no certificate of eligibility to issue surplus lines. There was nothing from the state of Florida that was submitted where she could draw a conclusion that they were in fact eligible to issue surplus lines covers. The record was devoid of it. For that reason alone, not even getting into the policy language, the exemption, we don't have the qualifications for it. And then 627 says every policy issued, every policy, whether authorized or unauthorized, that's my parenthetical, every policy falls under 627 unless you qualify to be exempt from it. And to do that, you need to be an eligible carrier, which Judge Kovacevic didn't have enough evidence to support that, and you have to issue the policy with this language as it is. And even if we get into the, I'll call it the late-produced policy, even if we get into that, that doesn't qualify either. Their own corporate representatives said that the piece of paper that they're relying on is not part of the policy. The statute requires that it be stamped on the cover page. Even if I had gone and found this thing in the cabinet of my client, if you look at it, the cover page looks no different. There's no stamp on it, nothing that would inform the
Judge Kovacevic. In one of her orders, Judge Kovacevic said that there was an issue about whether or not the second-in-time produced policy contained the relevant surplus lines language on a first page or, I think, a third or fourth page. Did
Correct.
She ever make a factual finding about that issue in her later orders or figure out she didn't have to given her other bases for the ruling?
She did in her first order on summary judgment, where she denied summary judgment, where she identified there was a factual issue.
Right, she did that exactly right. And my question is whether or not in issuing her final ruling, imposing the sanctions and then granting judgment, whether or not she ever resolved that factual issue or just left it there.
No, I think once she concluded that 627 applied, the fact that the claims administration statute hadn't been followed stopped the analysis.
Right, it didn't matter anymore.
Right. It's certainly there by inference. But that policy, the late produced policy, has no stamp on the cover page, which is one of the most important requirements. And the statute says must. It doesn't say, significantly comply. It doesn't say, do most of these. It has four portions, and each one of them uses the word must. And it's our contention that if you do not follow it, you don't qualify for the exemption, you fall back under 627 because 627 says that's where all policies go unless you have an appropriate exemption.
Where does the late produced policy have the surplus lines language?
On page 3. It's
not
on
the front.
Well, it's not on the cover page, and it's not on the first page.
It's on page 1. I mean, look, the statute uses different references for where these things have to be. One's got to be on the outside of the policy, and then one has to be on the first page of the policy.
Correct.
So it seemed to me this matched up pretty well. Now, there's a third requirement that may have missed, but those look to me to be exactly right.
But on the late-produced policy, it is the third page. It's the third page. And
it's the first two are the jacket, right? I mean, the first two are the jacket, and the third page is the first page
of
the policy.
No. That's not how I recall it. I didn't bring all the record with me, but the first page is the, you know, I call it the splash page, which is the logo and the company, and it says policy issued by. The next page has, I believe, some signatures by, like, the president. And then the third page is where that loose page, which, by the way, their corporate rep said, that's not even part of the policy. And we contend that the reason it must be stamped on the policy is because it must be stamped on the policy. The idea that a loose leaf can be inserted creates problems later, I think.
But the way this works is the Serval's Lines carrier is somewhere else. They don't do a business in Florida every day. So they've got this agent that does it, and the agent then can take their policy form, which they use all over the country or, for that matter, all over the world, and they can put some information on the outside of the policy. That's the agent's name. And then on the first page of the policy, they have to stamp this Serval's Lines information.
Correct. Yeah, but it's got to be stamped on the policy. And the record evidence here is that there is no stamp on the policy anywhere. And the problem is one of evidence, which we face here today, which is at what point did that third page get put in there? And we have their own corporate rep testifying that that's not a part of the policy. That becomes problematic. In terms of the policy that my client found in their cabinet, there is no evidence that it was in their possession back in 2012. The evidence is that it was found in the cabinet in 2017. The corporate rep said he was unable to identify when that came into my client's possession because the file had been, in his words, cannibalized by so many lawyers in the interim. But it's important.
So you think some lawyer cannibalized it by sneaking a policy in there?
Oh, no. No, but it could have been delivered at a later time. We don't know. We simply don't know.
Fair enough.
Anyway, I'm down to 25 seconds.
No, it's going up.
Oh, it's going up. All right, so I'm over by 30 seconds.
I think okay. We have your case.
Thanks, Judge.
Mr. Durock.
I'll work sort of backwards through some of that. We do have in the record the cover letter from 2012 from the SCAR insurance agent to All Florida enclosing a copy of the policy. His testimony was he delivered it face-to-face, thanks to Mr. Fulford, a representative of All Florida, it definitely was. In the record, his affidavit is at 188, his deposition is at 189, the 30B6 witness for All Florida is at 192. In each of those, there is the policy that Mr. Scar talks about delivering in 2012 with the language on it.
Let me ask you a question. On this record, regardless of how it all shakes out, how could you get a judicial finding on Houston Specialty being a surplus lines carrier as a matter of judicial notice? Isn't that a matter of proof?
The judge has a great deal of discretion on that. The records have to be on file with the state of Florida. In addition to the documents out of the record that we produced at the judicial notice, we gave the court.
But that's not something that's common knowledge, like knowing, you know, when Sunrise was in Atlanta on August 15th.
It is in the sense that we said to the court, if there's something other than this, here's the link, because it's on file, it's public, that says down at the Department of Finance, which is where the insurance commissioner's office in Florida is, this is where it is. And you can see right there, we're listed as a surplus lines carrier. Here are all the filings.
If it was so easy to figure that out, why would you seek to preclude questioning from the corporate representative in the third deposition about your status as a surplus lines carrier?
She was not the representative designated to cover those issues. That issue was already dealt with by the other witnesses that we designated. We actually designated as 30B6 witnesses the agents who were the vendors who were responsible for doing this, and they testified exactly about what they had done.
And that your client was a surplus lines carrier?
Absolutely.
And early on in the case, they did that?
No. When the judge extended the discovery during that 90s.
Oh, that's after the fact.
Yeah.
No, I'm asking you why you would object.
She was not designated on that issue. She was the claims representative. She would have no personal knowledge of that. She knows about the...
Corporate reps don't have personal knowledge about a lot of things.
But that
they
was not...
They become educated about those things.
Absolutely. That was not a topic we were expected to educate her on. We did educate her on the letter.
How much is there to educate her on if you think it's a matter of judicial notice?
She's got to go look.
How difficult is that?
They don't give us the topic. If they don't say this is the topic that you're a surplus lines carrier, we don't have the ability to go.
What did you provide with your request for judicial notice? I was disturbed about that issue. What did you provide?
I'd have to go back.
Other than a statement that you want the court to take judicial notice.
We provided some of the forms out of the filing, and I'd have to go back and look at the exact forms, but they were the ones that certified Houston Specialty as a surplus lines carrier for the
year. You provided everything from which you could determine whether it's a surplus carrier. Is that what you're telling us?
Yes, and then...
But not the policy that had the required stamp.
But not the policy.
Correct, because that's
just
not...
Just the status of the company.
Yes, the policy was in the insured's possession and the possession...
Well, what's the relevance of the status of the company if the policy has to have the information on it?
The only thing they're authorized to write is surplus lines insurance. Under 624, that makes them a surplus lines insurer. And then the question becomes, depending on the type of policies, et cetera, that are issued, where they put this language and what they do with it, whether they have to, if they do it.
But the other side's right, that just because they don't have authority to issue a policy, if they issue a policy that's beyond their authority, they still have to comply with the claims administration statute unless they properly issued a surplus lines policy, right?
No, and that is a decision this 11th Circuit has made already once before in the Lemmy versus Direct General, which is 559 F App 706. It affirmed the district court, where the district court said, an unauthorized insurer who violates the surplus lines law does not transform the insurer's product into a general lines that must comply with 627. And that was the district court's decision that was affirmed. It was not, I'm not quoting from the 11th Circuit.
I want to give you a chance to go back. The first thing I asked you was whether you pulled this out at the deposition. And you said, oh, no, we sent it to him the night before. That's Martinez says, absolutely not true.
That is my recollection, is we forwarded that email when we got it from the agent.
When you say we, who is we?
Me.
So the easy matter, you've got an email where you sent him the policy.
It may be a forwarding email that just says, here it is.
So that this would be easy to find out who's right about this. You get that in the record?
Yeah, there's, I don't believe so, and I could be mistaken, because as I recall,
when it came up at the deposition and he said, oh no, you're pulling this out right now, did you say, oh, I sent it to you last night?
I'd have to look and see if we said that on the record, but if I got it, I would have said it, but I might not have said it on the record. If the court wants that clarified, I'm happy to do a one-sentence clarification of that, because I just candidly don't remember, because it was 2 years ago, roughly. I know we turned it over immediately. I just don't remember if we turned it over. I'm 99% sure we turned it over that night, but it was large, too. So if it bounced back, we'd even have the rejection if it bounced back. So,
I think we have your case.
I'm out of time, Your Honor. Thank you.
The court will be in recess until 9 in the morning.
All rise.